Hi everyone, so this is Randy from the Bunny Chronicles podcast. So today I'm here with Phuc Tran and I'm really excited to bring him on. But before I do so, I would like to give an introduction of who he is. So Phuc Tran has been a high school Latin teacher for more than 20 years, while also at the same time establishing himself as a highly sought after tattoo artist in the Northeast. Tran graduated from Bard College in 1995 with a BA in Classics and received the Callinan Classics Prize. He taught Latin, Greek, and Sanskrit in New York at the Collegiate School and was an instructor at Brooklyn College's Summer Latin Institute. Most recently, he taught Latin, Greek, and German at the Wayne Flett School in Portland, Maine. His 2012 TED Talks, Grammar, Identity, and the Dark Side of the Subjunctive, was featured on the NPR's TED Radio Hour. His acclaimed memoir, Sai Gone, a misfits memoir of great books, punk rock, and the fight to fit in, received the 2020 New England Book Award for Nonfiction. He tattoos in Portland, Maine, where he lives with his wife and two daughters. So before I dive in about your amazing memoir, so welcome to the show, Phuc. I am really honored and so excited to have you on. And
thanks for having me.
Yeah, so 2020 is about to be over, and what can you say that this year has taught you that you didn't realize about yourself?
Wow. I think I'm just so incredibly grateful to 2020 for the challenges. You know, like I think, you know, we talk a lot culturally, I think we talk a lot about resiliency, and we talk about the need to model resiliency for our kids. And I think we talk about that as teachers in the classroom. But you don't really know if you can pick yourself up unless you get knocked down. And I mean, 2020 was a real, can I swear on your podcast? Yeah, it was a real, yeah, punch to the nuts. You know, I mean, it was really just so challenging. And, you know, and this is really sort of just an example. This isn't like sort of the focus of what I think of when I think of 2020, but like to go from ramping up the idea of like launching a book and like going on a book tour to all of a sudden being like, oh, just kidding. We're, you know, canceling everything. And there's this thing called Zoom. So I hope you like it because everything is going to be on Zoom. I think it's like the glass is half full or the glass is half empty, right? And you kind of just, you do what you can. So I think it was so instructive in resiliency, right? And trying to sort of make the best out of it. You know, and in some ways, like that is like the refugee narrative, right? Like for my parents, and I think for a lot of refugee parents, you know, like they come here, like they've lost their country, and I think a lot of people read their story and they think, oh my God, how did you do it? It's like, you don't really have a choice, right? what choice do you have? You're like, okay, sweet. Like, we're not dead in a ditch. And I don't know, it's pretty good.
So. I think that there's so much to be said about how our community, the Southeast Asian community, reacts to a pandemic, because our families have come from genocide, from devastation, colonialism, you name it. And I feel like in a way, for some, it re-triggers them, because there is this fight or flight mode. There is this panic of, oh my gosh, we need to survive. We have to protect ourselves and our family once again. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, in our communities, we have also suffered great losses. And it's very tragic. And among those losses were survivors of the Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodian civil wars and the genocide, for that matter. So I think it's such an interesting way to look back on what this year has done, and in a way, what traumas does it what does it re-trigger? And also, you are also a tattoo artist as well, and I wonder, how has that been for you, considering that you're in a pandemic, and the idea of being with a person for about an hour or plus. I'm not a tattoo person because I'm terrified of needles. Mm-hmm. I think the vaccine's probably the most I can take. That's about my level of knowledge of, that's about my level of tolerance of pain, but I am terrified of tattoos. But I actually want to know, what has that experience been like, and how it's affected your business?
Yeah, we're, you know, our shop is primarily appointment only. And even prior to the pandemic, you know, we were employing, you know, what's called universal precautions, which basically means we assume that everybody has everything all the time. So we are doing, you know, all the things that we can to protect ourselves and our clients. You know, most of that revolves around bloodborne pathogens, right? Like HIV and hepatitis A, B, and C. So really, like the new protocol is really like about, like, you know, it's about COVID. So it's like wearing a mask, or sometimes when I'm tattooing, I'll wear a visor and a mask. And we've got like air purification, you know, systems in place. But other than that, I mean, you know, it hasn't changed a whole lot for me, you know, and I feel as safe as I can, you know. I mean, I think I look at, you know, I'm playing the numbers game, you know, like I'm not a math guy, but I certainly love statistics. I don't generate statistics, but I love looking at them. And, you know, Maine's numbers are relatively low compared to the rest of the country. So I don't feel like I'm in any more harm's way than anyone else who's working.
Yeah, I think that, you know, these days businesses are, especially the mom and pop businesses and in your line of work too, which is considered non-essential. It is really galling to see what the Trump administration has done to ignore the livelihoods of people who are clearly affected by it. But I'm glad that you're still continuing on in a way that is very safe for you. And also looking at your Instagram, I really enjoy looking at the artwork that you have done. Were you always a creative artist growing up in high school? Were you doing a lot of drawings and sketches?
Yeah, that was actually, you know, like my art sort of career, as it were, or my art trajectory, sort of ran parallel to sort of my bookish tendencies in high school. You know, like in the book, we had actually cut out that whole narrative, just for the length of the book, and also because it just made the narrative a little bit messier, and sort of more unwieldy. But yeah, I mean, I've been drawing my whole life, and I actually, when I went off to college, you know, my intent was to double major in art and English, but I bailed on the both of those really quickly. But it was, I mean, it's there, you know, like it's sort of like in my DNA, as it were, from very early on. So it later in life, like I think I feel in some ways like tattooing found me again and sort of reawakened my love for the visual arts.
And I want to say congratulations on the critical success of your memoir, Saigon, which is also a
Thank you.
phonetic twist on the name of the city, Saigon, in Vietnam. Your book takes us on a journey from your parents' arrival to rural Pennsylvania after the Vietnam War, the painful process of you and your family's refugee resettlement, the struggle to navigate the in-between of your Vietnamese and your new assimilated but not complete American identity, your love of punk rock, languages, and literature, and your own personal healing today. I had learned about your pod, learned about your, not podcast, sorry, can't believe I said that. I had learned about your work this past year, and I heard you on my friend Tung Nguyen, who hosted the Worksleeve podcast, and Jerry Wan's Dear Asian Americans. So I had just finished reading the memoir, and I was completely blown away. There were times when I had to put the book down for several moments before I continued. There were certain family dynamics that I really did connect with, and especially pertaining to your father. You go into deep introspection through these certain events in your life that were often traumatic, but through your writing, it felt like you were in a thoughtful, understanding place, reflecting back on these moments. So I'd like to get a better sense of what your process was in writing this memoir, and also, did you expect, what were you hoping to expect out of releasing this memoir?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, where would you like me to start with process, I guess? Does that make sense?
Yeah, let's go with the process here because this was your first book that you have written, from my understanding. So you're taking on this gargantuan task of writing a full memoir about your life.
It's coming of age, right? It ends, you know, spoiler alert, it just ends at graduation at high school. You know, the memoir really, you know, so in 2012, I gave the TEDx talk, and that picked up some national attention. And you know, that was the first time that I had sort of publicly shared my story of, you know, being a refugee and growing up in small town America and you know, sort of all the things. And, you know, it was the first time that I had publicly talked about it. And I just figured, I'm just going to swing for the fences and like talk about as much as I can in, you know, 14 minutes, you know, like what could possibly go wrong? And so, and the response to that was really overwhelming. And I thought, and I was really surprised that people connected so much to, you know, my story, which I always thought was just weird. Right. And I just, you know, I never shared it because it just didn't sound like anyone else's story. And so I started doing like this live storytelling circuit here in Portland, Maine. You know, it's sort of like the Moth Radio Hour where you just like get up on stage and you have like 7 minutes to like tell a story. So like I would do like one or two events a year, and they were all real stories. So I would like sort of write out like an anecdote from my childhood and then get up on stage and tell the story. And based on that reception too, which was overwhelmingly positive, you know, I thought, oh, like maybe when I retire, like I'll write a memoir. It seems like people dig the stories I have to tell, and you know, I've got a shit ton of them. And then in 2016, my now agent sort of cold called me. She sent me this email and said, hey, I saw your TED talk, you know, are you interested in writing memoir? And so that's how that process got started. So, you know, I had the idea that I would someday write a book, but it was more like, you know, 30 years from now, not, you know, in 2016. But yeah. So that's how that happened. What was the second or third parts?
And then as you were writing this this memoir, what was your hope that people can take away from it? What was your intentions for the audience and for the community and for your family?
Gosh, yeah, that's so, I mean, and I'm gonna be like really, like, if I could be super honest, I'm going to be honest, and like my preface to all this is like, I hope this doesn't sound like I'm like a total, you know, asshole, but like, I think in the writing process, like I didn't think about the audience at all. Like I think that really helped me stay grounded and focused on writing the story the way that I wanted to write it. And in terms of tone, in terms of subject matter and sort of like thematic connections. Because I think like for me, I think like worrying too much about, will the audience like this? Will people like this? I want people to like me. Like, I think like that had been my early life for so much of my early life. And you know, it's a fool's errand, right? If you're constantly trying to please other people, right? And seek external validation. So I think for me, like the book was really like a private thing. And so I want, you know, there's a piece of advice from E.B. White, you know, and he says, when you're writing for an audience of one, meaning yourself. And so that really helped me stay true to myself and how I wanted to write it. And I think, you know, I think like what, it's hard for me to say what I thought, I didn't have expectations for what readers would get from it, because I think like readers are like the giant X factor in the whole equation of like, how does a book do in the marketplace? You know, like you don't know what readers are going to bring, like in terms of their own baggage and experience, and their own expectations. You know, like I think it's just so interesting to me. Like the book, any piece of art really is like a Rorschach test for the reader, right? Like the number of people who have written me and been like, your book was hilarious, you know, like it was laugh out loud every page. And I was like, oh, okay. Like, I mean, there are definitely like funny parts. Like, I don't know if I would say like, you know, it was my intent for it to be like, sort of like David Sedaris funny, you know, like I obviously like have a good sense of humor, I think, you know, and then there are other people who I think are struck by the trauma of it. And I think it's also like a false dichotomy, right? Like it's not, you know, either or, it's both and, right? Like that's life, right? Like that is my life. And I think that's many people's lives, right? Like there's like moments of deep hilarity and then moments of deep, deep tragedy. And I think, you know, we can celebrate and sort of revel in both those things. So, yeah.
You bring up an interesting reminder here, and I'm glad that you brought this to the table, because for a lot of us in the Asian American community, we are conditioned to play it safe, to do what is acceptable in a country that doesn't understand us. And so when you write a story, I would hear this from other writers and from people who are non-writers, and they're thinking, well, I don't have a story to tell. I don't know if it's going to be interesting enough. And I keep thinking back to the times where our narratives were never discussed in mainstream media. It was never discussed in the history books. They weren't talking about our stories, our humanity in trauma, our humanity in our successes, our humanity in our failures. And I think that this is a very important reminder of writing for yourself, because if you don't write, then someone's going to write that for you in a way that's not consenting. And then also that paints us as question marks. Who are we once again? So I think that what you're doing is you are working to dismantle the falsehoods that many non-Asian Americans have of our community. And but also I think it's also a really important reminder to write for yourself unapologetically, and by doing so, you're not diluting yourself, you're not cheating yourself from having to please others to make people comfortable, specifically with white people. You don't tell stories to make white people feel good about themselves in their own savior complex here. Your book and Viet Thanh Nguyen's and Kathy Park Hong's, among many others, who are writing to critically challenge that. But to critically challenge that is just really living our own truths, right? Mm-hmm. So, but yeah, and I would like to know about your own upbringing in the town of Carlisle, Pennsylvania. What can you describe about that town, and what was your relationship with that town growing up? Because for me, I grew up outside of Chicago. I grew up in Westmont, which is a blue collar city, or blue collar town. It's about maybe 30-40 minutes away from the city, and it was predominantly white, which is something that I can resonate with. And I would like to get a better sense of what Carlisle was for you.
It was part of that rural stretch of Pennsylvania, right? That's like sandwiched in between Philly and Pittsburgh. You know, it's like South Central PA. And it was just like small town America in like the 70s and the 80s, you know. It seemed pretty normal, you know, like we had a high school and there was like, you know, football teams and cheerleaders. And, you know, like there were, you know, kids who like, you know, the auto shop kids who like worked on their cars. And, you know, there was, I think like the two sort of maybe interesting features were that we had like a college in our town as well, Dickinson College. But Dickinson, you know, was a little bit separated from the town, even its campus, even though it's embedded in the town. Like, I think like the Dickinson students stayed on campus, and like we as townies were very clear when we were very aware of when we were like sort of trespassing, as it were, on Dickinson campus, which we did all the time, right? And then there was the Army War College. And so there was like a small handful of families and kids who would come through who were international, or at least not from Carlisle, whose parents were affiliated with the Army War College. But, you know, otherwise, like it felt pretty normal. At least in retrospect, it seemed pretty normal, and very kind of like small town America in all the sort of like best and worst ways, I think. The best ways were like, you know, you could like wander all over town on your bike and like, you know, and come home in time for dinner at night. And, you know, like the town was very small. So like you could like go from town, like from one end of town to the other and back and forth again on your bike, like all day long. But, you know, the downsides for, you know, Black and brown people were it was very white and pretty provincial and not always super welcoming, you know, I mean, like, so, I mean, I'll leave it at that. I mean, I don't want to belabor like the sort of like racialized elements of it, because I don't want to make it seem like it was specific to Carlisle. Like I think that was certainly my error growing up, was that I just assigned every shitty thing that I experienced to like Carlisle and be like, oh, well, when I moved to New York City or when I moved to, you know, Philly or Boston, like, there's no racism there because it's a big city, right? And we both know it's just like, you know, it's America's problem, right? Like it's not small town problem or big city problem. It's everybody's problem. So, yeah.
Great point there, because I just moved back to Westmont very recently to watch over my parents who are elderly. And looking back, I've always had a very frustrating experience with Westmont. But then, you know, living in Korea for a few years and then living in Chicago for a few years, yes, it was an upgrade to me. But there were also moments where I felt very othered. There were moments where I felt very isolated. And even living in a big city that's supposed to be, for Korea, which is Asian minority, Asian majority, and yet I'm also a minority because I'm Southeast Asian, so I would not ever fit into their society. And then living in Chicago, there's serious segregation, there's police violence, there's ICE raids in Black, Latinx, and Asian communities. So there's different dynamics that are going on in places that that you do live. So I think you do point up that, yeah, not all of my horrible experiences are tied to Westmont. I think that you make up a very important point that it is America's problem. This is not just a rural exurb community issue here. This is a systemic issue across the U.S. So how do you feel about Carlisle now, and what does Carlisle look like now than it did back in the 80s?
My parents moved away in the late 90s, so I have not like been there or spent any amount of time there in 20-ish years, you know, almost 30 years now at this point. So I can't, you know, I went back for a research trip and, you know, in 2017 or 18, I think, and 2018, I went back for a quick research trip. And, you know, as far as I can tell, I mean, like there are things that are different and there are things that are exactly the same. You know, I think I've heard from a lot of readers and friends and former classmates who are still there, who feel like it's a different place, like it's better than it was, I think. You know, I have to take their word for it. So I can't really say. I guess not being a, you know, not living there now, I think it's not my place to say or to give any kind of assessment for, you know, what it is now. But I can only give you my impressions when I went back a couple of years ago.
Thank you. And so your father, going into your memoir, your father was a lawyer in Saigon. And my understanding was that your parents worked in the U.S. Embassy. Is that correct?
Grandparents.
Yeah. And, you know, my father was actually an English translator at the U.S. Embassy in Phnom Penh, which is interesting connection that I was making in this book. But in America, your father was also working a blue collar job. And you shared about how your father was getting teased by his coworkers for having poor pronunciation. And I think about my father who went through something similar with his coworkers and the resentment that he felt at having to work at a job that he felt was beneath him. And I look at thinking about your own father, like your father has had a very respectable job. There was prestige in being a lawyer in wartime Vietnam. Right. And to go into a country where you have to completely start all over and people not caring about your educational background and how smart you are, and for him to get belittled by his own coworkers must have felt so traumatizing and conditioned him to be in a way bitter, because my father felt that way for a number of years working as a metal welder. I mean, this is something that he never dreamed of doing. And do you believe your father's job in America furthered Fiona's anger towards you and your family and this insatiable need to push you and your brother to be exceptional and carry out his unfulfilled dreams?
Ooh, yeah, that's so interesting. I mean, I'll say this, you know, like I, you know, just as a gentle corrective, like I think, you know, I think there was definitely some, a lot of anger and some bitterness in my father's life in Carlisle. I don't know if it was, I don't know where it came from. Like, I think, you know, on record, public record anyway, like on the 40th anniversary of their arrival or the fall of Saigon, my dad was interviewed by like a local Pennsylvania paper. They like tracked him down. My parents live in Southern California now in Orange County. And they interviewed my parents about coming to Carlisle and coming to America in 1975. You know, this is like 40 years after. So this article came out in 2015. And my dad was like, had nothing but gratitude in the article. And I think that is his public position. You know, like, I think he is forever grateful that, you know, we got a second chance. I mean, it's so hard to say where sort of my dad's sort of intensity comes from. You know, like, I think, you know, I think it's not helpful in my mind anyway, because it's like kind of a fruitless exercise just to wonder, like, would he have been exactly the same in Vietnam, right? Like, you know, and there's like this like kind of, you know, idea of intergenerational trauma, right? That like he was abused as a kid by his mother. And like, so, you know, then he parents the only way he knows how, which is like to beat the shit out of his own kids. And it's not until sort of like the cultural milieu changes that he's like, oh, I guess I can't do this anymore, right? Because certainly like in Vietnam, like it was totally normal to like, you know, beat the shit out of your kids. Like nobody, like it wasn't called beating the shit out of your kids. It was just called parenting, right? and so like there was nothing that would have told him that that was wrong. Because like it certainly wasn't wrong for my grandmother to like beat the hell out of my dad. So I think, you know, like, I don't even know if he's got the language, you know, as we know, like, I think our parents just, they lack so much vocabulary and sort of like emotional awareness around their own sort of internal processes to talk about why they feel the way they feel, or, you know, like, I think like that, like therapeutizing effect of Western culture, which I think is a positive thing, that ability or the permission to talk about an internal life, to talk about how you're feeling, to talk about disappointment, like that's not available to my parents, like not in the way that it is to me or to you, you know, growing up here in the US. So, you know, and again, I can't speculate on what it is that makes, you know, makes my dad tick, or what makes him be sort of like, what made him push me and my brother. You know, it was certainly like the immigrant thing, right? Like coming here, the refugee thing, right? Coming here and just being like, okay, like we made sacrifices, so you guys don't fuck this up. Like you better do well in school and, you know, all this stuff, you know? Yeah.
Mm. And I think as I will dive deeper into this memoir, I think about this a lot with my own parents, especially as they get older. And, you know, my father and I've had a very, very difficult relationship. And he also had serious mental health issues as a result of surviving the genocide. Mm-hmm. And I feel like when you are not, when he and so many other survivors of the Southeast Asian atrocities that were happening, there was no room or space for them to heal. When they arrive into the US or in Australia or in other Western countries, there was no counseling support. There was no opportunity for them to just put their bags down and just heal, or at least have the opportunity to have someone hear of their own struggles, their trauma. Mm. Instead, they were forced to go into work like 3 days later. I mean, my mom's family, like after, you know, arriving from the camps, it was get to work in 3 days. And yeah. So there was no time to process all of this, trauma and what to make out of what do we do next? How do we survive? How do we position our kids to make a living in this country and to do it well? So that way we aren't going to be entrenched in a lifetime of poverty.
Yeah.
So,
do you think that like that's a cultural piece that's what was like that, even if they had stayed like in, you know, in Southeast Asia, like I don't know if there's like a cultural blueprint for what healing looks like, right? Like for the mental health piece.
It's a great question. I think that you know, serving on the board for the Cambodian Museum, part of like the work that we do is to preserve the arts and music program. And what I have learned working with one of our resident musicians was that a lot of the survivors use music, as therapy to storytell, but to use music, because Cambodian arts, I'm not exactly familiar with Vietnamese arts, but I will say that in the Cambodian tradition, it is a big part of our identity. It's part of our own healing. It's part of our own way to navigate losses. Because if you hear Cambodian music, like the ballads, you hear this woman crying, wailing in the background as she's singing, which is, which I cannot sit through. But you hear these depressing songs, but they're coming from a very valid place. It feels like you're literally witnessing a person's sadness in front of you, but it is part of that healing process. But I think of how do we use therapy in a way that's not so completely westernized. Like, how do we incorporate parts of cultures that we connect to, because does our elder, like, I know, like, when I've had to take my dad to a psychiatrist, like, he's talking to a person in a white wall and with no personality, with no understanding of what the genocide was. And it's hard to sit through sometimes because I feel like I am punishing my dad by doing this. And I think about all these survivors who are, and not just survivors, but our generation, our millennial folks, people who were born well after the war, and what it does to our psyche when we are conditioned to deal with the racism, to deal with our parents' trauma, our grandparents' trauma, and taking on the weight of these expectations that overwhelm us, right? And also the environment that we grew up in, too, whether it's in an exurb rural community or in an urban area where there's also rampant poverty and violence. So it's a lifetime of trauma that's hard to unpack and to break out of, right? There is a part in your book on page 37, and I'd like to read this excerpt here. And it's also on chapter 2, beginning of chapter 2 of Crime and Punishment. You write, "Violence, physical violence, simmered as an unstable agent in my family's chemistry. Parents spanked and beat their kids. Siblings struck one another. Cousins punched cousins. Grandparents smacked their grandkids. Pillow fights turned into fist fights. Am I missing anything? I had no reference for what was normal. Behavior that I now in adulthood recognize as excessive, I accepted as wholesale as a child. My family's thermodynamics were volatile and explosive, but this was our reality. Violence and the threat of violence darkened the rosy tint of childhood. Sometimes violence settled disputes. Sometimes it splintered into more problems. It was how my family expressed their feelings of anger and disappointment and even love. They beat us because they cared for us, because they loved us, because they beat us. Maybe you were the victim of violence. Maybe you were the perpetrator. Maybe you were just an innocent bystander. At some point in the Tran family, you would be all three. The Troika." So, I want to get your response to this when you wrote the part. And what effect did the violence and punishment from your family have on you growing up?
Gosh. That's a layered question, right? Like, I think, just from the, there's certainly the physical sort of harm that it caused. There's sort of the emotional piece of it, right? That you don't feel like you can trust people in your family, like the people who you want to trust or you want to turn to, right? In moments of crisis, like all of a sudden now you're like, well, that person's just going to like beat the shit out of me because like I, did something wrong or need help, right? And so I think for me, I'll just speak for myself, like I think it made me certainly distrustful of a lot of my family members, or like because especially the older ones, right? Because you think like, as a young person, right, as like the small child in the family, like you think, okay, like isn't it like the adult's job to like take care of me, right? And like to protect me, you know, like if I'm the least able, and have the least agency in my family, it seemed to make sense to me that those people should look out for me, but they were also the people who were the first to sort of like inflict harm on you. Like, You know, like I got beat by my family long before I got beat up by bullies on the playground. You know, I think there's that piece of it. I'll leave it at that. You know, like I don't, I'm not a clinician, so I can't really diagnose, you know, all the other ways in which that violence has affected me. But I think those are the big pieces. And I think like, and then I think growing up, like I knew, you know, when I was entering fatherhood that like I needed to go to counseling because I didn't want to parent like my parents parented me, but I also knew that I could just do the opposite. Like that didn't seem like a thoughtful way to be a parent as well. And I knew that I didn't want to, you know, beat my kids like my parents beat me. Like that didn't seem great either. So in a positive way, I think it's made me more thoughtful as a parent and as like the adult, you know, the one of two adults in my children's lives. Like I think it makes me more thoughtful and hopefully a little bit more aware of the impact that I have on my kids. So that's an upside, I think.
And I thank you for sharing that because, growing up, it wasn't the bullies that necessarily scared me. It was really my parents or my dad's more specifically. And when you are struggling in school with your teachers, with your classmates and also like outside of your own home, it was hard for me to even turn to my parents for help because we had experienced the punishment, the shame, and how can you go to them? And even as an adult, I still find myself struggling with that. I rarely talk about what I do outside of my own family life because I'm still conditioned in a way to guard myself from not just the violence, but also the mental harm. So I'm constantly in a defense mechanism stance with them, even when they're not trying to be. So I feel like, you know, therapy can help with that. At least for me, it has, because I tend to have rage issues, which is also why I don't have kids too. I chose, I would never say never on that, but I think that when you grow up with so much anger and resentment towards your parents and the way they, my dad grew up with his own resentment, it's cyclical. And I realized that there were certain patterns that I carried from them. So it's something that we are still working through to better understand and to find ways to break more of these patterns because it is a lifelong process. There was one part in this memoir that really hit me particularly hard here, and it was the scissors incident. So your father chased you around with a pair of scissors after you just fell short of the honor roll when you started high school. Your father proceeds to cut up your records, your belongings. It was not just the fear of your dad physically threatening you, but that he destroyed things that were shaping up your identity, the things that you love about yourself, the things that keeps you alive. When you look back on this critical moment between you and your father, how did you still find the motivation to continue to do well in school despite your dad's anger? How did you still manage to have some semblance of a relationship with your father? And do you still find it hard to even let that experience go today?
Yeah. I mean, when it happened in the moment, like, you know, that was definitely, you know, like even before I wrote the book, like, you know, when I would, you know, talk to my wife about, you know, like we'd be having like a conversation about like sort of like biggest turning points in your life, you know, and I would always tell her, I was like, yeah, it was like when my dad tried to like, you know, stab me with scissors and I ran away from home, but I kept going to school. Like that was the turning point for me in a huge way. And I hope that in the way that the book is crafted, at least it feels like sort of like this climactic moment where, you know, for me, it was like the realization that, you know, like as I was looking around at my friends, you know, like my sort of like skateboarding punk rock friends, and they were just like floundering in school or, you know, getting jobs and, you know, dropping out of high school and just like getting apartments and like smoking weed or, you know, doing whatever. And I was like, well, I don't want that. You know, and
And I just thought, and then my friends who were escaping Carlisle were, you know, joining the army. And I was like, well, I don't really want that either. You know, like it was just kind of like this like narrowing of things where I was like, well, I got to go to school. And it was really like, you know, like it, school was like in a weird way, like school was the safest place for me. Like it was like the place where, you know, I had some, like I had a real sense of identity, like in the classroom, you know, like that was where like I felt like seen and valued and understood by my teachers and by some of my peers. And so that's really where, you know, even when that all went down with my dad, I was like, you know, for whatever reason, you know, like I think we're all wired differently. Like I just knew, I was like, you know, whatever happens, like you got to keep going to school and like you got to keep doing well. And like, and I was able to compartmentalize. So I think like, just to loop back to, you know, your question earlier about like sort of like a side effect of trauma, you know, like, and compartmentalization, I think is like a huge sort of result or a natural outcome of sort of like traumatic experiences that like you just like kind of like box up different parts of your life, right? And you know, I read this piece a little while ago about how, you know, compartmentalization is just another version of sort of like interpersonal violence, and that compartmentalization like allows you to survive, but it's definitely like a survival mechanism. It's not like a thriving mechanism, because like you're not ever fully integrated, right, as a person, because everything is in little boxes so that things don't touch other things, because like it's like a live wire, so to speak. But anyway, you know, I when I went back to live at my parents' house after I ran away from home after that whole incident, you know, I think my dad just like didn't talk to me for a long time, and I didn't talk to him. Like I think we were just like a ceasefire. And at that point I only had like 2 more years of high school. So we were just like, you know what, let's just get through this. Like, you know, like I don't want to be around you anymore than you want me to be around. And I mean, eventually like we would have conversations about things, but I was never super close to my dad. And I think like that was like really like the big, that was kind of like the cliff, you know, that our relationship went off of, you know, like I have a functional relationship with my dad now. And you know, to his credit, like he tried to apologize in his own way for being, you know, deficient in his parenting. You know, like in my 20s, he like actually sent me this long letter, like apologizing, but I was still so angry, like in my 20s, like I couldn't even hear it. It was so painful for me to read. And I remember getting that letter just being so pissed. I was like, because it just felt like a day late and a dollar short, you know, like, and I was like, what the fuck, you know, like, really, like, you know, like, not in the moment, not like 2 weeks later, not like 6 weeks later, like 10 years later, like, you're going to send me this, like, I'm sorry letter, you know, like, when I'm like a full-fledged adult and like living my life and I don't even live with you anymore. And now you're going to apologize, you know, of course, like, I hadn't had therapy then. So like, now I can appreciate, you know, that, like, what that took for him to apologize. And you know, I mean, for like for a Vietnamese dad, right, to be like, hey, I'm sorry I was a shitty dad, like that's incredible. And I want to give him credit where credit's due. You know, I mean, we have the relationship that we have. You know, I think like the best thing that's happened for me really is just to recognize that like I can't ask him to be someone he's not. Like I can accept the relationship he's able to give me, and you know, it is what it is. And there's not a lot of disappointment for me now, just because, you know, I'm not asking him to be like super dad or, you know, whatever.
Thank you so much for sharing this, because this resonates with me a great deal with the way you respond to this, because, you know, school was a safe place for me too. I think of my teachers who have actually helped me along the way. And that's actually the reason why I was able to not fall into the dark path that some of my friends, that your friends have also succumbed to, whether it's drug use. And unfortunately, there were some classmates that I knew that died of drug overdose and got into trouble. And I always think to myself, gosh, I wasn't that far away from that path, because I felt like I was ready to snap at some point. But my teachers really did save me from what could be a very difficult path. And I think that there was no other options. Like, what do I want to be? Because I, in my heart, as you would also share, you're a good person. I want to be a good person. I'm not a horrible person. I don't want to be like my dad. I don't want to be like my relatives who are doing these horrible, shitty things, mm-hmm. right? And you talk about how you were struggling in your relationship with them years after, right? And I mean, there was a time when I didn't speak to my dad for several years. And when a father or a parent apologizes, you have all kinds of reactions because, one, you don't expect them to ever apologize. Yeah, that's the right. first thing.
Yeah, right.
Second, if they do, what is their motive? What are they trying to get out of this? Because they see you graduating college. They see you at least having a decent life. Mm. So are they trying to ask you for anything from you? And I mean, those are things that you get suspicious of folks. I mean, sure. I can't speak for the whole Asian American experience here, but I think that there's suspicions and there's questions of trust that have already been dismantled. And it's hard to put that back together because once that trust has been broken, how does it get rebuilt? And do you have a say in how that trust gets rebuilt without having to take on so much emotional labor on your end, you know, while the other person who has caused the harm hasn't really done their part. So I think that that's such a difficult path. Some people have reconciled, for others, it's still ongoing. And I mean, I can't tell people to forgive their parents who've been abusive, right? I think that it's on them to figure out what is their best way of healing. This particular piece in this book was so troubling to me because it brought back a memory that I never talked about in my own life that I felt was hidden, but it was particularly painful for me because in eighth grade graduation, I fell short of the high honor roll. And I remembered each student was called whoever got high honor roll with honors. And when my name did not have that Randy Kim with high honors, it upsetted my dad so much that, like, I did not get a chance to hang out with my friends. My dad took me away with my family and just started berating me, telling me how I was a failure in the car for about an hour, and I was crying. And I knew at that point that I could no longer love my dad like that. Yeah. I could no longer go up to him anymore. I could no longer ever want to seek approval from him. So I felt this intense anger towards him that it would result in physical fights where I would overpower him because I was taller by that point. So by that, puberty is a real fucked up thing because when you become stronger than your own parent and what they had just done, it's more like, okay, well, here's my revenge. Here's your own karma back. And I look back on it, it's like, that was where I was operating from, that I made sure that he was not going to get involved in anything in my own life. And I think that carried with me for such a long time. And reading that particular chapter when he cuts up your favorite records, I cannot imagine. I mean, he didn't go that far, but the berating was enough for me. The fact that you're being told that that he no longer loves you because you can't succeed, that's really harmful. And and I think that it took me a long time to start to make peace with that because he himself was operating from a lot of trauma in his early life. And I had to go back and understand his roots. Where is it coming from? And also, it made me think about my own harm to other people, right? Because you start seeing yourself in him too. And you're like, I don't want to be like my dad, but yet I'm too close to the fire, right? So when you talk about intergenerational trauma, the experiences that you carried through, what behaviors did you inherit from your parents in grandparents. And I know that you had just, you know, talked about the breaking the cycle of trauma since you are now dad of two young daughters, but I'd like to get a better sense of what did you inherit from them? You saw yourself, oh my gosh, I am causing problems to, whether it's your friends, whether it's to past loves, your wife, kids.
Yeah. I mean, gosh, I feel like you should be interviewing like all my ex-girlfriends or something. Tell you. I think I was terrible at communicating. I think like early on, I would say this is all like pre-therapy, right? Like I think when I hit my mid-30s, I think that was when I was like, oh, like I need to like sort my shit out, you know, or
I'm in that same age now. I'm 37.
I think I was like 35, 36 when I started going to counseling to sort of like process all the stuff that happened. And I think I was like really bad at communicating. I had the IED temp, you know, like the like roadside bomb temper, right? It was like everything was fine. And it was just like explosive. And I was like, you know, like just lose my mind, like just with anger. I was like a huge like grudge holder, you know, like, just not very forgiving, you know, and I think worst of all, like not very forgiving with myself, right? Like, I think the thing that you inherit from that kind of a childhood is you learn to love yourself least. That's like the longest and most harmful trauma is when you don't feel like you deserve anything. And it's like this kind of like scorched earth policy, right? Where it's like, well, if my parents are going to hate me, I'm going to beat them by hating myself more than they hate me. And that's how I'm going to win. Ha ha. You know, like it's totally perverse. Right. And, because that way, like they can't harm you. So there's like, yeah, there's a lot of healing that had to come from that, and a lot of like learning how to like be emotional and express my emotions and express my feelings in a way that's healthy, right? And in a way that's relationship building and relationship strengthening, and it's not about power, right? Because I think like in my household, like it was like all about power, right? And power equals violence, right? Like so I think it was about trying to sort of navigate a relationship that isn't around power and power struggles and like dominance and violence. You know, like I'm sure shit never gonna like, you know, I was like, I'm not gonna like hit my wife, you know, when I don't get my way, or I'm not gonna hit my wife because like I want to show power over her. It just seemed fucked up to me. Like that, it didn't seem healthy. You know, and I understand that like different relationships have different dynamics, and but I think like violence and domination is not a relationship, right? That's like master servant or, you know, whatever. I don't know. It's not, you're not living a life together, right? A shared life together, which is what I wanted. It just seemed happy, right? I mean, like, I think it's all I want. It's like, I'm like, okay, how do I live like my best and happiest life, right? And be the best person I can be. How do I be the best spouse that I can be? How do I be the best parent that I can be, right? And that's everything, right? So like, that's the opposite of compartmentalization, because I think like, you know, we all do better when we all do better, right? So it's like if I'm a happier person and more content with myself, like I'm gonna be a better everything. I'm gonna be a better teacher. I'm gonna be a better tattooer. I'm gonna be a better coworker. But you know, if I hate myself and I'm just like a miserable, you know, son of a bitch, like I'm going to be terrible at all those things. So I think that's like the deprogramming of compartmentalization, that you may think that, you know, trauma in one place doesn't affect how you are in another place, but it's not true. It's, you're the same person, right? Like you're the same person in all those situations. So how could you not have like, you know, sort of a wounded past or an unhealed piece of yourself not affect all the other ways that you bring yourself into a situation?
Such a beautiful navigation you just shared, because like for many of us who still live in the diaspora and who are struggling with, you know, reconciling with their family members, but really with ourselves, how do we understand our own harm? How do we look into loving ourselves? What is it about us that keep us going? what are we most proud of? And it's hard because we are conditioned to not ever feel proud of ourselves because for sure. It seems like we're not doing enough. There's an imposter syndrome that we carry around. There's scarcity mindset that we carry around too. And those are hard to identify right away until you get really deep into that, oh no, I'm about to hit to the edge of the cliff here. I'm about to fall off. And God knows I've gone through that, many times. And some of my guests who have, shared that. And I'm glad that you have, worked to identify these problems and recognize where you have fallen short. And what is your relationship like with your daughters? And also particularly, I'm interested in your relationship with your mom, because your mom was in a way seen as an enabler, but also it's kind of like she's between a rock and a hard place, because my mom, as close as I am with her, it's very hard because she has allowed, in your mind or in our minds, that was allowing the violence to happen, but yet she was also the recipient of harm too, mm-hmm. from your father and also from her own parents growing up. So mm-hmm. I think it's such a complicated issue because you want to be close, but yet you get pulled back because mm-hmm. because that parent, that mother figure was not there in your time of need.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, I think 1,000% all the things that you said. I think there's also for me, like the language barrier with my mother, like my Vietnamese is not great, it's like kitchen Vietnamese, So like I have like the fluency of like a second grader, So I don't really, there are more complicated things that I would love to talk to my mom about, but I just don't have the vocabulary for it. And frankly, I don't know if she would understand. I'm sure she would, but it's just, it's one of like the small tragedies of like, the diaspora, right? Especially like you go from first generation to second generation or 1.5 to two, it's, you're going to lose things, and that's one of the sacrifices that we made, right, by coming here and being alive, is that like we lose touch with each other, in any number of ways. And we're reading from different rule books, like my parents are reading from this like, Confucian filial piety rule book, where they're just like, kids love their parents no matter what, right? Like no matter what. And my brother and I are reading from this like American Western playbook where it's like, parents don't beat the shit out of their kids, and kids can talk to their parents about things, and like, why can't we talk to you guys about it? So it's like, it's just kind of like very, it is like, it's a communication and cultural gap, right? That we just have totally different scripts. It's powerful for me to recognize that, but I'm not sure, what we can do at this point. So my relationship with my mom is pretty functional at this point, I'm not estranged from my parents, like they text and call me and, like send my kids gifts and things like that. But I could also go like a month without hearing from them and like, that would be fine too. Like I'm not super close with them. I think my relationship with my daughters is good. Obviously like I'm not sure you'd have to ask them almost like what sort of a dad I am. I think I try to find a sweet spot between being, fun, but also still like having high expectations for them, they ask me to play with them all the time, which I'm struck by. Like, I think that's really cute. And I think about how I never asked my dad to play with me as a kid. So like, that obviously isn't the only metric for good parenting, but like the fact that like my kids, they're 7 and 10 now, like they still want to spend time with me, they still like we do things together, I think I'm glad that I have avoided the pitfall of letting the pendulum swing too far the other way, where like I'm just like, I want to be my kid's best friend and not be a parent and never say no to them and spoil the shit out of them, which I'm definitely not like that either, So like, I think my kids probably think I'm a stricter than their friends' parents, which is fine by me. But I'm also, I think like, happy to like, play, have a snowball fight in the backyard or play hide and go seek or, like build Legos with them and watch movies and stuff like that. So like, hopefully it's a good balance.
How old are your daughters now?
7 and 10.
Yeah. Aw, that's really cute.
Thanks. I'm sure they'll have plenty to talk to their therapists about when they get older.
Yeah, and I'm glad that you can also share, and I hope that they get to, read your memoir as they get older and have a better understanding. And I know it's also hard to ask your parents to read something that they can't understand. And I wonder if there will ever be a Vietnamese translation of this memoir too. I think it'd be interesting. I'd like to see how that would be received, especially when you get into the different layers that you can't communicate with your own parents because of the language barrier and the broken and how our broken tongue, as my friend pointed out, stings our parents' hearts. Something that one of my friends shared on her poem, and it just hit me incredibly hard because there's a lot of things that I would like to say to my mom, my dad, my grandma who had passed away 2 years ago. I could never be able to articulate my appreciation for her. And I think that's really incredibly hard when you don't have these opportunities, even though you're still very present. It's not there for us completely, and we go through that cycle of question marks because we don't know enough about our parents. And which also brings up the 45-year anniversary of the end of the Vietnam War, and what comes to your mind when you think about that part of history and your place in it? And have you been back to Vietnam?
Gosh, I haven't been back to Vietnam. For a long time, I tried to convince my parents to actually go back with me, because I thought it would be such a rich experience to go back with them and to have them point things out. But my parents are staunchly anti-Vietnam right now. They will never go back. To them, it feels like it's still occupied by the winners of the war. And they just don't want to give any money to the communist government there. So, what's odd is that my parents are such staunch holdouts for that. My dad's sisters and his brother have gone back. My dad's brother, my uncle, bought a beach house in Vietnam. My brother and my cousins have gone back. So I have not been back. I finally got sick of waiting for my parents and trying to convince them. And I was about to go back, and then we had kids. So now I just would rather go with my kids, but I'm going to wait till they're a little bit older because, you got to get all these shots and stuff to go. So I will go eventually. But I'm the one person who has not gone in my family yet.
Yeah, I've been back to Vietnam about 10 years ago, but to Cambodia, I have yet to make that visit because it feels too personal for me to go into a country that I have no relatives in. And I think my friend Anita said it best in one of my favorite poems, and she said, I will return to a place I have never known that burns a hole inside my heart the size of home. And that hits me incredibly hard for me because my parents don't see their former homelands as home. But for me, it was a part that's still missing, that there's something that I need to go back to. I may not have been born there. I may not be able to speak the language, but there's something that does not complete us in our journey, right? And I hope that you get that opportunity to visit Vietnam and also for your kids. I think that would also be very important to get a better understanding of how your arrival was and where did that arrival come from. And you also experienced, racism experience on a microaggressive level. And I don't want to take too much time, but I will say that when you were looking to publish that op-ed piece in high school calling out a racist classmate, your advisor warned you not to because he told you not to publish that piece and suggested a topic for you that was safe. Now, I was a college journalist back in my community college as an 18-year-old, and I remembered doing a piece on the Southeast Asia Symposium, which it was the first time I had learned about the Khmer Rouge genocide. And for me, it felt personal. And I remember my white editor-in-chief said, we're just going to not need this piece. And I wrote a good piece on it, at least from my own heart. And all they kept was the picture of the Opsra dancer that I took that made the front page. Nothing else. And I have to admit, it really started to make me believe that I'm not cut off for this business. And, you know, it made me not want to continue journalism because of that. Mm-hmm. And I think that to many Asian Americans who are conditioned into silence for fear of retribution, this was an example where we are confronted by our values versus our survival. And mm-hmm. how did you process these forms of microaggressions of anti-Asian American behavior in both your community and your field of work?
I mean, I think I was just in survival mode. You know, like I think when you're in survival mode, which I think you inherit, you know, it's your inheritance, right, from your parents as refugees, right? Like you're, you know, like you think about like Maslow's hierarchy of needs, right? Like it's like it's very low. You're just like food, shelter, right? Like don't die. And I think like the microaggression stuff, right, is like more about like, do I have a place in the community? Do I have value? Do people see me for who I am? Or you know, and those are higher up on the hierarchy, like once you've established those sort of lower pieces. So I think I was just, especially in high school, like everyone's just trying to survive high school in some form or fashion anyway, you know? So I think, you know, it's like, it's funny, like I recognize the microaggressions for what they are, you know, they didn't land on me that hard only because I also had rednecks who were like trying to like beat me up, like physically like beat the shit out of me. So like in my brain, I was like, well, that's clearly like pretty bad. Like I would, you know, I'm just going to try and avoid getting beat up or at least fight back. But like, you know, people were just like going to say like shitty racist things to me. I was like, whatever. Like, I mean, you know, in some ways, like those dynamics, and this is not to belittle other people's experiences of microaggressions at all, but for me, like, I think I just was like, well, I can either choose to give that power or not, you know, like I think in so many of those situations, you know, I'm always thinking about what are the choices for me that give me agency in those things, you know, and I think in like those microaggressive situations, like I just think, well, I can either give that, you know, person power and have it ruin my day, or I can just be like, yeah, fuck it. You know what? Like, I'm just moving on. I'm going to do my thing. And, you know, it doesn't speak any, it doesn't talk about the person, right? Like it doesn't put me in a position where I'm calling anybody out or asking people to change their behavior. Like I recognize that, you know, but again, I think I'm in just like survival mode. And I think in those survival situations, like I think I, you know, I was sort of just doing what I could do to get through high school. Mm.
And with that said, any new projects that you're currently working on, will we see a potential sequel to this? Because I'd like to know about the college years now in your 20s and your, I mean, I know that's a lot because you're still processing this memoir.
Yeah.
But also I'm curious to know what 2021 will look like for you and where can, you know, people really follow up on your work?
I've got some contributions coming up in some anthologies, hopefully. So I don't want to say more about that. I don't want to jinx those. So I've got some two things that are going to be in anthologies and then, I'm working, I have a homework assignment from my agent about some follow-up pieces. You know, I'm not sure if there's going to be like a Saigon part two, the college years, or, you know, Fuka trying to adult, you know, adulting years. But I've got some other ideas for sure. I definitely love writing. It's super hard and super challenging, and I'm a glutton for punishment. So there will be something and maybe some fiction too, who knows, you know, like I think that for me, like I feel really fortunate in that I'm not, you know, because I have like tattooing as like my, you know, main hustle. Like I'm not writing for a paycheck, which means that like my writing is really coming from a place of passion, which I think is where like my best writing is going to come from, right? Like it's like the writing that like has to happen and is super urgent and sort of, you know, sort of like true to the punk rock spirit, you know, like I'm doing it for the art and not for the paycheck. So.
Yeah. I look forward to reading more about your work too. And where can people actually follow your social media?
Yeah, I'm on Instagram, Fuke Skywalker.
I like that name.
Thanks.
Clever name. Yeah. And I think when I was listening to Jerry Wan, you made a note that this is the best way for people to pronounce your name. Like,
yeah.
Luke Skywalker instead of fuck Skywalker. although I kind of like the latter more. I do like the latter more personally. So, but yeah, last question. I want to say, you know, before I end this, you know, I really hope that people get a chance to grab a copy of your memoir, Saigon. I am in love with this memoir. I read it within a week. And I've actually encouraged other of my friends who could identify with this book to grab that copy. And I was having like Instagram messages back, having back and forth with them, like, oh my God, did you read page 50? Did you read? I mean, tell me when you get to the scissors part. But it was such an enthralling read for me because it's something that I identify so closely to, and especially from a Southeast Asian male perspective, it really draws in certain experiences. Like I had different experiences from you, and I think what you're sharing is not just representative of the millennial generation X Vietnamese American folks. You're writing from another perspective, from your own experiences, and there's so many stories that we've, you know, yet to uncover. But I'd like to ask you, now looking back, what will you tell your 15-year-old self?
Ooh, what advice would I give my 15-year-old self? I would tell myself to trust myself, and to just, you know, do the best that I can. Yeah, and that to listen to myself.
Thank you so much for your time. I really enjoyed this conversation. Gosh, I feel like we can extend this to another hour, but you know, there's so much to uncover. But I really hope that people take the time to read this memoir and see themselves in these stories, and also read the works of other Southeast Asian artists, because as time is ticking, with many of our elders who have survived these tragedies during the 70s. It's also important that we not only incorporate their history, but also our history into this as part of our way of documenting our journey, and also setting the course for what the Southeast Asian American experience can look like down the road. So I really thank you for bringing this into the universe, and what a gift it has been. Wow. So.
Thank you, Randy.
Yeah, I can't wait to connect with you and follow you on your work.
Thanks. Thank you very much.